Hello everybody, welcome back to the Flicks the Church Forgot. This is the second part in a two-part episode reviewing the upcoming Arrow Blu-ray release of Theatre of Blood starring Vincent Price. If you'd specifically like to hear the review of that movie then and the new disc, then check out part one of the episode. But for now, I'm going to be doing what we normally do on the Flicks the Church Forgot, and that is to explore the deeper themes and meanings of the film. In particular, drawing on some of the theological observations of the troubles that poor old Edward Lionheart finds himself in, the Shakespearean actor who took revenge for the hurtful critics' comments by murdering them all. So join me as I explore that experience that so many of us go through in life, not just Edward Lionheart, but perhaps you, and perhaps I. Rejection. Nobody likes rejection, but we've all had it at one extent or another. I can remember standing at school while friends picked players for the football team and how, you know, I was always pretty much the last to be picked because at the time I just wasn't that good at sport. And to be honest, I'm not that good at it now either. And I used to feel like a right chump standing there, you know, and being among the last to be picked. I remember my first ever job interview. I was a teenager and I wanted to be a shelf stacker in a supermarket called Quicksave in the UK. And evidently, I didn't have the requisite skills to put a loaf of bread on a shelf because I got a rejection letter from them. You know, sorry, Peter, we don't feel like you're cut out for this job. Oh, man, it just felt awful. And I remember meeting a girl at university who I absolutely fell for. And for the first time in my life, I thought, you know what, I'm up for committing in a proper long-term relationship. And I bought her a Valentine's card. And I remember I used to wear this aftershave called Jupe. So I sprayed it in the air and wafted the card through because I was classy that way. And, you know, I left the card in her pigeonhole saying, "Be my Valentine." I'm pretty sure you're supposed to do it anonymously, but I wrote my name on it. You know what a doofus. And anyway, I met her and said, you know, "Hey, did you get my card?" And she just wasn't interested in me. And that I should just move on. And I remember sitting there in the pub later, peeling the label of this little bottle of Beck's beer, thinking, you know, that didn't go very well, did it? And just feeling pretty gutted about it. Rejection is a horrible feeling, and I'm sure you know what it's like. You know, you do your best, you make an effort, you sometimes give everything you've got, and people reject you still. That certainly seems to be the case for Edward Lionheart, who commits his entire life to perfecting Shakespeare and yet is mocked and disrespected by the very people who pull the affirmation strings, the critics. And it's not just other people or critics out there who can reject us, but even those closest to us can even reject us at times, and that can particularly hurt. In fact, some of you even listening to this podcast now may be experiencing extreme rejection in your life. You might even feel like rejection is the defining label on the back of your neck. Some of you are so terrified of rejection that maybe you live your life avoiding it. Well, looking at it from a Christian perspective, and obviously, you know, as you know, I'm a Christian or a theist or whatever you want to call it. If you're not a Christian, that's fine. Feel free to listen to this as an interesting thing. I'm not telling you how to think. I'm just sharing a Christian perspective. And so from a Christian perspective, it's interesting to see that Jesus appears to have known full well what it was like to get crappy reviews for his performance, because he and Edward Lionheart would probably have plenty to discuss in the rundown theater along with the meth drinkers. You know, Jesus and Edward saying, "You know what, Edward, I've been there. I've experienced heartbreaking rejection myself." You see, there's a bit in the book of the Gospel of Mark when Jesus like rocks up to his hometown, the place where he grew up, and he's a man who knows full well how fruitful and good his life has been. And so really, people should be falling over themselves saying, "Wow, you know, you're amazing. You helped create the world and everything." And yet he is rejected. And who is he rejected by? His own people. He's rejected by his own family. Listen to this.
Jesus left there and went to his hometown, accompanied by his disciples. And when the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were amazed. "Where did this man get these things?" they asked. "What's this wisdom that's been given him? What are these remarkable miracles he's performing? Isn't this the carpenter? Isn't this Mary's son and the brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon? And aren't his sisters here with us?" And they took offense at it. Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor except in his hometown, among his relatives, and in his own town." He could not do any miracles there except lay his hands on a few people who were ill and heal them. And he was amazed at their lack of faith.
Now in verse 2 to 3, the people question Jesus and he says, oh, he's not special, he's just a carpenter, he's just Mary's son. And in verse 3 it says that they take offense at Jesus and that Jesus' own sisters there are taking offense at him too. And I think this is something people don't seem to realize. I certainly hadn't realized that Jesus' own family thought he was psychotic. You know, if you just even to glance back over at Mark 3:21, it says, and when his family heard about this, they went to take charge of him, for they said, he is out of his mind. Take charge of Jesus, they say. I can only think the modern equivalent of that is when we take charge of someone because we think they're out of their mind. We call that sectioning. And it's almost like they want to have Jesus sectioned or something because they say he is so disturbed he cannot be trusted. And with the exception of Jesus' brother James, who wrote the book of the New Testament called James, his brothers and sisters seem to utterly reject his claims to be the Son of God. And it's not only Jesus' family that reject him, but his own community where he grew up. In Luke 4, Jesus turns up and preaches in Nazareth, right, his hometown. And it's the first thing he's done after resisting the devil for 40 days and 40 nights in the desert. And so Jesus is fresh off this sort of amazing time of like spiritual warfare, and he's completed it and done it all really well. So he's like, yeah, you know, Top Gun music playing in the background, like he's really done well. And the first thing he does is he goes in to preach to his hometown, to a crowd in Nazareth, and he sets out what he wants to do in his life. And, you know, he's going to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, sight for the blind, all this sort of stuff. How do his friends respond? They resent him. They're like, who do you think you are? It's funny how rejection can sometimes come to us soon after a high in our life. Something goes really well, and then straight after, we're like sort of punched in the gut by the world. And Luke 4 gets pretty nasty. In fact, it gets pretty horrible. You know, the crucifixion was not the first attempt on Jesus' life. If you read Luke chapter 4, after Jesus preaches in this place, they grab him as a mob and they actually try to throw him off a cliff. I can't help but be reminded of the first critic death in Theatre of Blood, where all the meth drinkers are just sort of swarming around this critic and just dragging him this way and that way, just wanting to do him in. I mean, imagine how heartbreaking that must have been. You know, if Jesus is indeed a real historical character and this happened, and many historians say he was a historical character, whether or not he was actually who he says he was, that's a different debate, I suppose. But, you know, that this man in history was so rejected and isolated by his family and his friends, those he grew up with, who he spent more time with than the disciples. Like, he had dinner with these guys. When he was a carpenter, he fixed their wobbly tables for them. He brought them water when they were ill. And as a child, he played games with them. They gave each other piggybacks across the hills of Nazareth. And now they think he's insane and talentless. In Theatre of Blood, the critics just want to destroy Edward Lionheart professionally. But in Jesus' case, they resent him so much, they actually want to just not just kill him professionally, but actually physically. And eventually, of course, they get their way. Who is it that shouts, crucify him? It's not the Romans, it's the Jews. It's Jesus' own people demanding that he's pounded into a piece of wood. So for that point in history, this is like the ultimate rejection for this guy. Now Jesus, the man with his amazingly fruitful life, is utterly rejected, and it sort of doesn't make sense. And even Jesus seems baffled. In verse 6, he says he was amazed at their lack of faith. And with Theatre of Blood in my mind, I can't help but think of Vincent Price's face when he was in that plush London apartment with all those critics just after the Critics' Choice Awards had been announced. And Vincent Price is just so baffled by all of this, and he's looking at them like, how can you be doing this to me? How can you be so cruel and blind? And you can almost imagine Jesus being bundled off saying the same sort of things. How can you be doing this? You know, it's hard to take rejection from an enemy, but it's even worse when you're rejected by those you respect or from your friends. Some of you actually might well have been rejected by people close to you, from best friends. Some of you might have had husbands or wives who've chosen someone else and rejected you. Or you just feel the little painful rejections every day that comes from comments or lack of love from others. Some of you might even have children who've loved and nurtured and tried with them, and they have actually turned their back on you. Rejection is a bitter pill to swallow, but it's even harder when it comes from the ones we love. And it might even be the case that, you know, you might be listening to this and you've had experience of Christians in church and you may have felt rejected by them. And I wouldn't be surprised because, you know, I meet some Christians and they can be just so hardcore against people that it just feels, man, you're like, just don't even, you're not even interested in me, never mind love me. And so you may have suffered rejection at the hands of the church. Well, I guess I would just say, if this account of Jesus is true, then it means that Jesus knows how heartbreaking rejection is, that he knows the pain and the bafflement of when loved ones turn on us. But we can learn, I think, from this example. I'd say, firstly, you know, we do not let rejection slow us down. Jesus didn't seem to do that. I can't help but think that in the early years of Edward Lionheart's career, as he's starting, you know, treading the boards of Shakespeare, he obviously kept on going despite the bad notices he was getting. And so he just, you know, okay, I'm just going to keep going. But eventually he starts to give in. He slows down from focus on his craft, as it were, to what the critics were saying. It's very normal and very understandable. But that is where his undoing began. And secondly, we don't let rejection brew into resentment and hate. Because, you know, Jesus may have been baffled by the rejection of his family and hurt by it, but it never seems to have made him hate them or write them off completely. There's an interesting quote in Theatre of Blood when Ian Hendry's character, who plays the critic, I think it's Peregrine Devlin or something, it's an amazing name, he says, "After a while you start to resent an actor if you have to keep giving them bad notices." And it's a good point. Lionheart resents the critics, but actually they're here admitting that they pretty much resent him as well, which is never a good way of handling things. So we try not to let rejection brew into resentment and hate. It's not very helpful. Understandable, perhaps, but not helpful. But thirdly, and crucially, we don't let the rejection of others, even if it's our close family, define who we are. Because I think it's that which stops us living life in its fullness. I mean, if you look at verse 4, in the midst of his people saying Jesus is nothing, Jesus comes back with something actually quite remarkable. He says, "Only in his hometown, among his relatives and his own house, is a prophet without honor." What's fascinating about what he's saying here is this is the first time in the Gospel of Mark that anyone has referred to Jesus as a prophet. And here is Jesus himself making the reference of himself. In other words, he's boldly asserting his identity right in the face of their rejection. It's like he's saying, "Loser." They're saying, "Loser, loser, loser." And does he drop his eyes and say, maybe you're right. Maybe it is my family after all. Maybe they've got a point. They do know me better than anyone else. Is that what you do when people reject you? You sit there and, maybe they've got a point. Maybe I am a bit useless. Maybe I'm ugly. Maybe I'm stupid or whatever. Do you lie in bed at night thinking that maybe the critics are right? I can't decide if Lionheart in Theatre of Blood was starting to doubt his own talent after all the criticism, or he was just furious that they couldn't see his talent. I wonder if maybe it was the latter. But either way, the attitude and the labels of others, they are his prime focus, more important even than life itself. Well, Jesus refused to be defined by the critics. They're saying, "Loser, loser," and he says, "Prophet, actually." And he may be astonished and even heartbroken at the horrible rejections, but his faith in who he is and who his Father is, his Heavenly Father is not shaken by other people's opinion, even his close family and friends. Why are we so afraid of rejection? And I am too, by the way. I used to be a youth worker, a youth pastor, and I think that was my first proper long-term job. And back then, I used to think I had this like really thick skin. But I realized that now that was only because I hardly ever got criticized. But when I became a church pastor, then, well, the gloves were off for some people, and some people would like grumble about the way you do things. It's a normal thing to happen in any job, I suppose. Not everyone is happy and they grumble about you sometimes. But that was hard for someone like me because, as sad as it sounds, I don't want to be rejected. I don't want people to like me. And I know how needy and crappy that sounds, but it's sort of true. I preached a sermon in a church a little while ago. I won't tell you where, But after it, people were saying, oh, that was very helpful and powerful and all these lovely things. And that was great. And I thought, very nice. Nice to get some compliments. But then one guy came up and he just nipped me on the shoulder and said, can I just take you to the side 1 minute? And I thought, oh dear, this isn't going to be very good. And it was this old elderly guy. And he said, why do you young preachers... I thought, oh, here we go. He says, why do you young preachers let your voice go down at the end of your sentences when you pray? I was like, what? And I said, what do you mean? And he says, when you pray, your voice goes down. And it sounds like you don't have confidence in your prayer because it goes down in pitch at the end. Now, to be honest, I was like, what are you talking about? I didn't understand. Because to me, going up in pitch at the end of a prayer sounds even worse. You know, like, dear God, bless us. Amen? Maybe? But actually, it's irrelevant if his criticism was accurate or not. I tell you, the point is this. I forgot all the nice things those people had said about me. And I focused on that one little rejection for like days afterwards. Completely out of proportion. Like I just thought, man, I need to grow up. I'm too bothered up sometimes about what people say. Because we hate rejection for that reason. We put far too much stock in what other people think of us. And certainly as a Christian, I'm supposed to be paying more attention to what God says about me. But in practice, sometimes I care more, I suppose, than what human beings say about me, which is pretty tragic. And I suppose that's something that Edward Lionheart certainly did. Now, Theatre of Blood would be a pretty rubbish horror film if Edward Lionheart suddenly got all zen and forgiving and not sought vengeance on his critics. That would be an incredibly boring horror movie. But imagine instead that this was Vincent Price, not as the character, but as the human being, real-life actor Vincent Price. Imagine if in real life, if he had to deal with criticisms, then he did sometimes get criticised for being a schlocky B-movie actor. That stuff must have hurt sometimes, but he kept on going. He didn't fall into some manic search for respectability. He certainly didn't murder anyone, as far as I know. And that's what I love about Vincent Price in Theatre of Blood. You can see he's getting a kick out of doing the Shakespeare bits, but when he goes all manic and gothy and campy and horror-like, he never once pulls things back. He's never like, oh yeah, this is an opportunity for me to show myself as a real Shakespearean actor. And those will be the most important bits, and I'll dial the rest in. No, what he does, he says, you know, I don't care what the criticisms are. I'm going to have a go at doing Shakespeare, and he does it brilliantly. And he's done that sort of thing, I think, in the past anyway, maybe on the stage. But, you know, how ironic that when he throws himself into this role, but also with great gusto and all of the campy horror bits, how ironic he ends up getting such good reviews for his performance in this. Well, listen, let me start pulling some of this together, I guess, in more practical ways. I suppose what I'm saying is this. If we want to live productive, balanced lives, I think we've just got to get over rejection. And it's not easy, because some of us hate the idea of being rejected. But it's necessary, I suppose, to have a truly fruitful life. And particularly if you're involved in the creative industries, it's just par for the course that people are going to assess what you do. The thing is, so many of us try to control events so that we won't experience rejection or criticism. But we just can't control events. Things are out of our hands in so many walks of life. But we can, of course, control how we process rejection in our minds. We choose not to let it define who we are. You know, I know a lot about rejection at the moment. As many of you know, I write sort of horror, psychological thriller novels, or at least I'm trying to, and you know, I'm currently in the process of trying to get published, and I have a literary agent, which is fantastic, and she's been sending my novel around, and at the moment there's some possible interest, but it's taking a long time, but there's also been a fair few rejections, and while they've been very complimentary rejections, they're still rejections nonetheless. And you know, I could sit there and go, I think I'll let this put me off. But right now, no, I'm not going to do that. I will stick with it. And even if I am never accepted for publication of the novel writing, then in a way, that's not the main issue. I suppose as a Christian, I think the real focus in my life is supposed to be, I'm supposed to be like more like Jesus is. And so oddly enough, when I get rejected, it's giving me opportunities to walk down the roads that he did. And I guess that means I get more of a chance to be like him. It doesn't mean I particularly enjoy it, but... you know, every cloud, as they say. The tragic thing is, so many of us try to play it safe because we can't handle rejection, so we try to avoid it at all costs. We don't, you know, step out. We don't share our opinions. We don't share our creative gifts or ideas because we're scared of rejection. And I think that sort of thing is such a shame. Understandable, but tragic nonetheless. I think if we have that sort of creative spark in us or whatever we're going to do, we just got to go for it and grit our teeth when the audience is, as it were, served back. You know, I never did get that job in Quicksave. I never became a great football player who everyone wanted on their team. But that girl who rejected me in the pub that night, she actually ended up becoming my wife. And we have a little girl and a little boy, and we met at university. And she rejected me that night in the pub because I wasn't a Christian. And I was like, what? I'd never heard of that before. It was like the biggest excuse ever. I thought, surely just tell me the truth. That can't be a real reason. But she said it was, and it got me intrigued, and I ended up going to the Christian Union, partly because I was interested in spirituality and the supernatural and all that sort of stuff, but also, frankly, because I thought she'd fancy me if I started looking all religious and stuff, so I went along to that. I'm not ashamed to say that was my motivation. What happened was that I started to explore the claims of Christianity and thought about it in all sorts of different intellectual ways and deep ways, and I started becoming convinced of its reality. But let me tell you something. I applied for Lancaster the year before she did, because I'm a year older than her, and I'd planned on doing advertising, but I didn't get the right grades, and so the university rejected me, so I went to a different university instead through clearing. And I dropped out of that university after a term because the course just wasn't working out. And I felt like the biggest failure. I remember standing in the phone box outside my dingy house in Nottingham, which is where it was at the time. And the December snow was falling around me. And I was trying my hardest not to cry on the phone as I was telling my mum that I was really considering. I just couldn't do this anymore. I was going to drop out. And what a failure I felt. What a reject. And so after that, I reapplied to a different university the following year for a different course. And so I began. I just happened to begin in the same year as my future wife, who just happened to live in the building close to me. If I'd stayed at that university that time, you know, and avoided rejection, then I would never have started that the university where my wife was, as it were. And yet I did. You know, I started this place and I met this woman, and, you know, through her, it helped me become a Christian, but also obviously got married, got kids, and kids that wouldn't exist. Now I realize, you know, life can be random and you don't want to read, I think they call it patternicity, too many patterns into things. But all I can say is, you know, the rejection at the time felt really horrible, but it changed my life for the better. Because if God is real and if he exists, then maybe he's an expert at turning the most hideous of rejections into new beginnings. Jesus on the cross, I suppose, is the ultimate example of this, the ultimate image of rejection that in Christianity actually ironically becomes the absolute source of life. There's a bit in the Bible that says that in this world of rejection, God will never ever leave us or forsake us, which is incredibly reassuring, but some people will. Some people will break your heart and write bad things about you or say bad things about you or write little comments on Twitter or underneath YouTube videos and stuff. And some people will not recognize somebody's amazing acting at Shakespeare and not give them the Critics' Choice Award for 1970, even though they devoted their life to it. When that happens, it makes so much sense to move in the Edward Lionheart direction, to grow bitter and vengeful and even possibly murderous. But maybe life's too short for that. Maybe it's better to dust off the velvet cape, put the poodles down, and just move on. Well, that's it for another episode of The Flicks the Church Forgot. Remember, you can follow me on Twitter at RevPeterLaws. But until next time, don't forget The Flicks the Church Forgot.